Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thank you for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Syria's civil war is grinding on in its ninth year. And while Bashar al-Assad appears secure in Damascus, thanks to help from Russia and Iran, huge questions remain for Syria, including the future of the main opposition group battling the regime, Kurdish autonomy in the north, and what to do with thousands of captured ISIS fighters. Joining The Crisis Next Door to talk about Syria is Stephen Cook, Eni Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also authored the book False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. Stephen, thank you for coming back on The Crisis Next Door.
My pleasure, Jason.
Let's start with the mass surrender of ISIS fighters to the Kurdish-dominated Syrian Democratic Forces. The SDF now holds thousands of ISIS fighters it's captured, many Syrian and Iraqi fighters, and around 1,000 foreign fighters. What are they going to do with those fighters, and how big of a threat is that to the SDF?
Well, this is a huge problem. There are, as you point out, large numbers of ISIS fighters who've now given themselves up to the SDF. And the SDF, as capable as it has proven to be as an American ally in the fight against ISIS, is not well equipped to hold on to all of these people. This comes at a time when the United States is saying that it's going to be leaving and drawing down its troops to anywhere between 200 to 400 forces. And the Europeans have not indicated that they are going to step up where the United States has stepped down. So we do confront a situation where the SDF is holding on to people. Their record in terms of keeping people, either not abusing them or even letting them go, is not a great one. So this is one of the things that in Washington we talk about when we talk about catastrophic success, the idea that it's very, very unclear what you do once you succeed. There hasn't been a lot of planning for this. There will be an effort to return people to their home countries, but the SDF is not a state. It's a group of armed group affiliated with a political party that is seeking autonomy in northern Syria, but it doesn't have the means to engage in the kind of diplomacy to return people to their home countries.
Can the Kurds use this as leverage with the regime in Damascus, perhaps to get help from the regime in Russia to handle these ISIS fighters, or lest it let loose these fighters around the rest of Syria and that the regime in Russia and Iran would then have to deal with them separately?
Well, you make a good point. The SDF certainly wants something from the Assad regime, and that is both a combination of protection as well as autonomy. The Kurds are quite concerned that when the United States finally does pull out of Syria, that it will be left vulnerable to Turkish forces. And the Turks consider Washington's Kurdish allies in Syria to be part of another terrorist organization called the Kurdistan Workers' Party. It's all extremely complicated. So with the United States leaving, the Kurds have sought protection from the Russians and from the regime. How these ISIS fighters can be used as leverage, it remains to be seen. Certainly, they don't want the regime does not want ISIS to reform in some other part of Syria. But again, having extremists out there targeting the regime does certainly help it politically. Because the Syrians have been making the argument that they are fighting terrorism, not fighting a civil war.
the Islamic State caliphate has really been stamped out for the most part. But a lot of these ISIS members that have surrendered don't seem very repentant, and including the wives that had children with these members. Does it seem like there's still a window of opportunity for the Islamic State in Syria if this issue can't be handled in the right way?
Well, I think undoubtedly that ISIS will continue to live on in some form or another. The caliphate clearly has been defeated, but you can't defeat a worldview. You can't defeat an ideology with bombs and bullets. And those ISIS fighters that haven't been captured have scattered to other parts of the region, other parts of the world, and they continue to carry this worldview. And as you point out, even those who've been captured continue to adhere to the worldview that made the caliphate possible, even if it was not around for a very long time. So my strong suspicion is that the anti-ISIS coalition that was formed in 2014 to defeat the caliphate will remain active around the globe to combat ISIS 2.0 or ISIS 3.0. But this is really a struggle that needs to go on within the Muslim world, because as much firepower as this international coalition can bring to bear on ISIS cells, this is really an ideological and political battle that needs to be fought by Muslims against other Muslims who have taken their faith and used it for violent means.
The Kurds felt abandoned earlier this year when President Trump said he'd be pulling all U.S. troops out of Syria. Now it's being reported that upwards of 1,000 troops will remain in Syria. Do you think this provides much relief for the Kurds?
Well, you know, is it really 1,000 troops? A week ago it was 200 troops, then it was 400 troops, and then, you know, 1,000 troops. It's sort of rounding up because you're not taking, you know, you have support and all those kinds of things. So we really don't know what the number is. The hope is that with the number, whatever it is, that the United States can enlist its European allies, the French and the British, to commit as many as the United States has there. And then you would have a force that would be formidable enough to deter the Turks from attacking the SDF. It would deter the regime. It would provide a means which the United States would have leverage with the Russians over the future of Syria, and it would keep a close eye on Iranian activity in Syria. That is the hope. The question is whether this will be the actual policy. The president, it is true that the president has been consistent in the fact that he doesn't want to be in open-ended conflicts in the Middle East. But this policy has swung wildly from one end of the spectrum to the other. So tomorrow we could find ourselves discussing an entirely different number when it comes to the number of residual troops left in Syria.
You mentioned the Turks. Erdogan made his move on the Kurdish-held enclave of Afrin last summer, threatened to move deeper into Kurdish-held territory. How important is it for the Kurds in Damascus to reach a deal for limited Kurdish authority?
Well, this is the regime in Damascus has said that it will reestablish its control over all of Syria. But there is a belief that the Kurds and the Assad regime can come to some type of agreement that would afford the Kurds some type of autonomy while creating the impression that Syria is in the hands of the government in Damascus. That would take a significant amount of, I think, diplomatic creativity, but one supposes it's possible. And that is a way for the Kurds to try to protect themselves from the Turks. Although the Turks are in Syria in large ways, they are really hammered between what their goals are and the fact that they need the Russians for a variety of different reasons, and the Russians support the Assad regime. They do not want to get headlong into a conflict with the Syrians because of what it might do to their relations with the Russians.
Stephen, would an autonomous Kurdish region provide stability for the region? And how would that affect Kurds living in Iraq, Iran, and most of all, Turkey?
Well, the argument has always been that Kurdish autonomy or Kurdish statehood in one of those countries that has large numbers of Kurds in them would destabilize the rest. And this is what motivates the Turks. They believe that the SDF, the major Kurdish component of the SDF, is part of a terrorist organization, and that will destabilize Turkey and will establish a terrorist state on Turkey's borders that could lead to the, in a nightmare scenario, lead to the breakup of Turkey. That's been the kind of traditional fears of Kurdish national aspirations. Of course, in Iraq, the Kurdistan regional government in the northern part of the country, three provinces in northern Iraq, has been able to establish good working relations with both Turkey and Iran, mostly Turkey, and has proven itself to be, you know, responsible. Of course, when it wanted, when they held a referendum on autonomy, the Turks and the Iraqis and the Iranians all cooperated to undermine those aspirations. So Kurdistan is a piece of the puzzle in a Middle East that is changing, that can either be a source of great instability and the traditional fears about Turkish Kurdish national aspirations could come true, or it could over time be one of these places that can be part of the region and well integrated into the region, even if it's autonomous zones within existing states.
We've gotten conflicting reports about Turkey and Iran working together to go after PKK members in Iraq. Iran has denied that it's helped the Turks in this case. What do you make of that? And does that complicate this issue even further?
Well, regardless of what Turkey or Iran's relations are with the Kurdistan regional government in Iraq, they are going to continue to target this terrorist organization called the PKK and its offshoots in Syria and Iran. This would not be the first time that the Turkish armed forces and the Iranians have cooperated against this affiliated terrorist organization, nor will it likely be the last. I think the Turks are publicizing it for electoral reasons. There are local elections that are coming up in Turkey on March 31. It is a closely fought race. And even though it's local elections, there are high stakes involved. And President Erdogan and his ruling Justice and Development Party and those officials have every interest in kind of playing up the fact that Turkey is involved in these anti-terror operations ahead of these local elections.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the latest developments in Syria with Stephen Cook, Eni Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Let's shift our attention to Idlib, the last bastion for Syria's rebels, a city with 3 million people packed into it. Russia and Turkey have agreed to protect Idlib from a regime offensive, but Damascus continues to attack the area with aerial bombardments. How long until this agreement falls apart and the regime finally makes its move on Idlib?
Well, the agreement is falling apart, and there have been subsequent agreements to try to shore it up that have also been falling apart. Just today, the regime was shelling parts of Idlib province, and I think that the major problem is that Turkey, which had agreed to disarm extremist groups within Idlib and bring other groups under kind of an umbrella of moderate, for lack of a better term, moderate opposition that would satisfy mostly Russia in order to put off an offensive, has completely failed to do that. I think it was fairly clear that the Turks weren't going to be able to do that. In fact, not only did they fail, but the most extreme of these groups now really controls most of Idlib province. It remains unclear how long the Russians are going to wait. As is his practice, Vladimir Putin is playing both ends of the stick here. He has agreed with Turks on patrolling Idlib on keeping the regime forces away. But at the same time, the Russians have also said that Idlib is an open sore and it needs to be taken care of. So I suspect without any kind of dramatic diplomatic change in the situation, we will probably see agreements on Idlib break down over time and significant violence continue.
Is it even remotely possible to isolate the jihadist groups from the millions of people packed into the city?
Idlib is probably the most complicated problem in Syria at the moment. And it given the fact that the most extreme of these groups, which goes by the initials HTS, is really the group that is most powerful and most in control, it seems unlikely that anybody who's targeting Idlib province can disentangle civilians from fighters. Certainly, neither the Russians nor the Syrians has never really been a concern of theirs. They've attacked parts of the country indiscriminately, regardless of the consequences for civilians.
You mentioned HTS, the former Al-Qaeda offshoot. They've been developing a local Islamist government in Idlib. Are they preparing for life after arms? Are they hoping to be the next Hezbollah transitioning into a respected political party in the country?
Well, it is an interesting contrast to ISIS. HTS has been, and we're speaking relatively here, relatively more moderate, has developed means of governance, has won the support of local populations, and thus has been more durable. It's entirely possible that HTS is looking towards a post-conflict role in the governance of Idlib, but it strikes me that this is a non-starter, at the very least, for the Assad regime.
The U.S. designated HTS a terrorist group last summer, and HTS protested, saying it doesn't threaten the outside world or represent a danger to it. Do you see HTS as a potential threat to those outside Syria, and is it a threat to those within?
Look, one has to at least account for the possibility of evolution of groups. But this was an Al-Qaeda offshoot. That has the means to do damage, not just in Syria, but in other parts of the Middle East. They have been focused on Syria, quite obviously. But that means taking the word of an extremist organization that was connected to Al-Qaeda. I'm not sure I'm prepared to accept what they say on face value.
Turkey obviously has to be concerned about Idlib, given its proximity to the Turkish border and the possibility of thousands of refugees pouring across from Syria. Might Ankara have enough of an incentive to make sure that the situation doesn't become an all-out offensive and fall apart and have to receive all those refugees?
It absolutely does, and that's what has driven the Turks to make agreements with the Russians on Idlib. And that is why you see Turkish and Russian patrols, either Russians on one side of the de-escalation zone, Turks on the other side of the de-escalation zone, because the Turks are quite rightly fearful that any kind of assault on Idlib would impact them by driving refugees into Syria. The problem that the Turks have is that they have been unable to meet the requirements that they themselves agreed to as part of a series of agreements on how to deal with Idlib.
How important is it for Moscow to get along with Ankara? Does Putin fear Erdogan shifting his allegiance back to Washington?
Well, it's certainly the case that Putin wants to have good relations with Turkey, if only to weaken the Western alliance. Turkey is a treaty ally of the United States through NATO, the second largest military in the North Atlantic Alliance. And to the extent that Erdogan has sought Moscow and Moscow's assistance to protect Turkey's interests in Syria, the Russian leader has taken advantage of this and has sought to create space or drive a wedge between the United States and Turkey. That's not the only reason why there are very difficult relations between Turkey and the United States right now. But certainly the Russians have taken advantage of this situation to deepen these differences. Putin wants to be very careful, because a misstep would probably drive the Turks back to the United States, something that he doesn't want to happen.
Stephen, it's very difficult, as one could imagine, for reporters to get in and out of Idlib. Do we have any idea how effectively humanitarian supplies are getting to those people trapped in Idlib?
It's entirely unclear what the real situation is in Idlib. As you point out, HTS has established mechanisms of governance, has established some support among the population, so that the situation is likely not as dire as in places where the Islamic State has held sway. But we don't quite know what's actually happening within this area.
9 years into the war, is reconciliation remotely possible at this point between the rebels and regime?
Well, you know, long-range studies of civil wars indicate that they last between 7 and 15 years. So we are coming up kind of right smack in the middle of that. And although it seems that the Assad regime will prevail, it has not completely prevailed yet. Idlib suggests that, despite the fact that the regime is seeking a military solution to the problem, that it may end up having to be a political solution. So far, though, the parties are not quite ready to negotiate in good faith over the future of the country.
Certainly no signs of peace on the horizon. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us again on The Crisis Next Door.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
We've been joined by Stephen Cook, Eni Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.